Welcome, everyone, to the Western Museum of Flight. I'm Cindy Maka, the director. How vital it is that we acknowledge and commemorate our war heroes of the past. And we are especially privileged today to have someone who not only got all of the information and commemorative information firsthand from his father, who experienced it, but who is also a very gifted writer who has recorded this for the rest of us so that we may share in it. So, ladies and gentlemen, Steve Snyder, award-winning author.
Thank you very much, Cindy. I appreciate that. Well, it's a pleasure to be here today. September is a busy month for me. Earlier this month, I was in Belgium to attend the 80th anniversary celebrations of the liberation of Belgium and ceremonies to my dad and his crew. And then next week, I'll be in New Orleans to attend the 8th Air Force Historical Society reunion. So I'm glad I had the time to fit this in, and thank you for coming. Growing up, I knew the basics of my dad's World War II history. I knew he was a B-17 pilot. He was stationed in England with the 8th Air Force, flew bombing missions over Europe. His plane was named the Susan Ruth after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time that he went overseas. And on February 8th of 1944, his plane was shot down, and he was missing in action for 7 months, but he evaded capture and eventually made it back to England. But it wasn't until I retired in 2009 that I had the time to really delve into my dad's history in more detail. And my parents had kept a lot of material from the war years, and I just wanted to go through that and organize it and maybe learn some new details. But there are two items that were really significant. One was a diary that my dad wrote while he was missing in action about his plane being shot down, which is absolutely riveting, so much so that it was included in two books that were written. On the left is The Mighty Eighth by Gerald Astor. It was about the 8th Air Force, which was stationed in England and flew high-altitude daylight precision bombing missions. The first mission was on August 17th of 1942. And the goal was to hit military and industrial targets to cripple Nazi Germany's ability to wage war. The 8th Air Force got its moniker, the Mighty Eighth, by noted historian Roger Freeman because of the number of bombers they could put up on missions, which numbered into the hundreds. And on December 24th of 1944, 2,000 bombers hit targets around Berlin. It's hard to imagine what that must have looked like, having that many bombers in the sky at the same time. The other book was First Over Germany by Russell Strong. It was about the 306 bomb group that my dad was in. Russell Strong was a navigator in the 306 and became its historian after the war. They got the moniker or motto First Over Germany because the 306 bomb group was the first bomb group to hit a target in Germany, Wilhelmshaven, on January 27th of 1943. The other item that was really significant were all the letters that my dad had written to my mother while he was stationed in England before being shot down. And reading those letters was fascinating. And my dad was really candid in what he wrote in these letters. He talked about what bombing missions were like, what life was like at the air base, what life was like in London and England at the time, escapades of him and his crew. And as I mentioned, I just became fascinated with the story, and it became my passion. I started reading book after book about the air war over Europe. I went on the internet, spent countless hours doing research, downloading declassified military documents. I went on a quest to find relatives of all my dad's crew to find out what information they could give to me. Started going to reunions and listening to World War II veterans tell their stories. And then finally, 3 years into my research, I just came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his crew was so compelling and so unique, it needed to be told, so I wrote a book. It took me 4.5 years from the time I started my research to the time that the book was published. The first half of the book builds up to the day that the plane was shot down, and then the second half of the book is all about what happens afterwards. And it's just not about my dad, but it goes into detail about what happened to each member of my dad's crew and about all the courageous Belgian people that risked their lives trying to help them. But I couldn't have written the book if it wasn't for two Belgian gentlemen. On the left is Dr. Paul Delahaye with my dad. A picture was taken in 1994 at the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Belgium. And the picture on the right is me with Jacques Lalot. That picture was taken 20 years later at the 70th anniversary. These two men were young boys during the war, and they were greatly affected by it. They saw firsthand that, you know, atrocities committed by the Nazis against their family and friends. And later in life, they became local historians, and they interviewed all these Belgian people and members of the Belgium underground about events that took place involving my dad and his crew. And they documented their testimony, and they gave me unbelievably detailed information that would have been lost forever without their dedicated research. So I owe them a huge debt. Initially, my dad didn't go into the Air Force as a result of the first peacetime draft in U.S. history in September of 1940. My dad went into the Army in 1941 in April in the infantry, and he was stationed at Fort Lewis, Washington. And when World War II first began, the U.S. military was woefully weak. They ranked 18th in military strength in the world behind Romania. And they were also very ill-equipped, as you can tell from the World War I vintage uniform that my dad is wearing here. 3 months later, he married Ruth Hempel at First Lutheran Church in Pasadena. My mother was born and raised in Pasadena, as was I. It was shortly after she graduated from UCLA, where she was a classmate of the legendary Jackie Robinson. I also went to UCLA. When I was there, I was a classmate of Lew Alcindor, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. My dad was born in Norfolk, Nebraska, and then he moved to Glendale when he was 13 years old with his family. Then a few months later, Japan bombed Pearl Harbor and the United States was at war. Well, my mother was very fearful. The future was very uncertain. So she decided to go up to Washington over Christmas to visit my dad, and 9 months later, Susan Ruth was born. Well, my dad was concerned how he was going to support his new family as a new bride, baby on the way, and he didn't feel like he could do that very well with a private's pay in the Army. So he decided to volunteer for the Air Force where he could make more money, especially if he could make it through pilot training and become an officer. So in June of 1942, we went through pre-flight training at Santa Ana Army Air Base, and then went through the various stages of pilot training. This slide's a little busy, but there were three main parts of pilot training. From left to right, you have primary training. And then if you made it through primary, you went to basic pilot training. And pilot training was really tough. 40% of the cadets that started pilot training washed out. And they either became bombardiers, navigators, or perhaps gunners. And then after basic, they went into advanced pilot training, and that's where they separated the pilots out. Some pilots went into single-engine planes or fighters. Typically, that was the shorter pilots. And then other pilots went into bombers or transports. I also think it depended on the personality of the pilots as well. It seems to me, from the fighter pilots I've known, they tend to be pretty cocky, you know, have big egos, be risk takers, and pretty independent, whereas the bomber pilots tended to be a little more level-headed and team players. Here you see my dad in primary training in Santa Maria, California. And this was a big moment in his life. It was the first time he soloed, and you couldn't wear your goggles on top of your helmet back then until you had soloed. You see him smoking a cigarette. I think almost everyone smoked during the war. These are the three types of planes he flew in pilot training up on top. In primary was an old Sturman biplane. And then in basic training, a Volte Valiant single wing plane. And then in advanced training, a twin engine Curtiss-Wright AT-9. My dad graduated from advanced pilot training in April of 1943 at Douglas, Arizona, where he got his commission as a second lieutenant in its pilot's wings. And from there, he went on to transitional training, where he learned how to fly a four-engine B-17 bomber, and then off to operational crew training, where the various members of the team or the crew came together, and they learned to operate as a team. And then once deemed ready, they were assigned overseas to the European Theater of Operations. On October 21st of 1943, my dad and his crew reported to the 306 Bomb Group at Thurlow, England, which is about 60 miles north of London. This is what the base looked like back then. It's no longer there anymore, but the surrounding countryside looks just the same. It's all rural farmland. There is a nice little museum there that I've been to several times. It has a tremendous amount of memorabilia and artifacts in it. Here you see the emblem of the 306 bomb group. In the 8th Air Force, there were three air divisions, and the 306 was in the 1st Air Division, which was signified by a triangle. And then every bomb group had a letter designated to them for the 306 was H, so a triangle H was an identifying symbol of the 306 bomb group. In addition to being the first bomb group to hit a target in Germany, the 306 was also the longest-serving bomb group in the 8th Air Force. They came to England in September of 1942, and they didn't go back home until December of 1946. They stayed on after the war, involved in the Casey Jones Project, which was the aerial photo mapping of Western Europe and Northern Africa. Many of you have seen the 1949 movie 12 O'Clock High, starring Gregory Peck. Well, that was based on a true story about the 306 bomb group. The fictitious bomb group in the movie, the 918th, was derived by multiplying the 306 by 3. Another distinction of the 306 bomb group is that their flight surgeon, Dr. Thurman Schuller, was responsible for convincing 8th Bomber Command General Ira Aker to implement a mission limit in the spring of 1943. Prior to that, there was no mission limits, and these combat crews quickly realized that they would never, ever make it home. They'd either be killed or shot down and become prisoners of war. Dr. Schuller recommended a mission limit of 20. Aker set it at 25, but at least these combat crews had a light at the end of the tunnel and some hope of making it back home. Every bomb group had four bomb squadrons. These are the four in the 306 bomb group. On the upper left is the 367th, nicknamed the Clay Pigeons, because they took more losses than any other bomb squadron in the 8th Air Force. And my dad's squadron is in the lower right, the 369th, Fightin' Bitin'. They had one of the best records for least losses during the war. I always like to point out the ground crews. There was a combat crews, got all the recognition and all the glory, but these ground crews are the ones that kept these planes flying. After a mission, these bombers would come back in, and these ground crews would stay up all night long, usually in very inclement weather, sleet, snow, rain, ice, mud, repairing battle damage, doing maintenance on the plane, replacing engines, replacing tires. And they took great pride in these planes. They really considered them their planes that they just loaned out occasionally to the combat crews to fly missions. So they are really the unsung heroes. Here you see my dad's crew, a B-17, had a 10-man crew. There were four officers who were kneeling in front. My dad's in the lower left. He was the first pilot, and as such, the commander of the crew and the plane. And then going across, you have the co-pilot, the navigator, and the bombardier, and then standing behind them are the six enlisted men, or non-commissioned officers. Five of these men came back home, but five of them did not. This is not the Susan Ruth. It was just another B-17 that they took their crew picture in front of after they arrived in England. I would like to point out the nose art in the upper left-hand corner. It's interesting that the Air Force is the only entity that allowed their planes to be painted. The Marines didn't, the Navy didn't, but the Air Force thought it could help the morale of these young guys if they could personalize their planes. And they were very creative in what they painted and named their planes. You know, many times it was a cartoon character, but more often than not, it was a scantily clad or nude woman. You know, after all, these guys were in their late teens and early 20s and were virile young men. The 306 flew B-17 bombers. The 1st and the 2nd Air Divisions and the 8th Air Force flew B-17s, and the 2nd Air Division flew B-24 Liberators. It was nicknamed the Flying Fortress because of the armament they had on the plane. They had 13 50-caliber machine guns, so they could put out a tremendous amount of firepower, and they could also take a tremendous amount of battle damage and continue flying. There were three different models of B-17s flown in the war. Initially the E model, but they only made about 500 of those, so they were quickly phased out by the F model, which was then phased out in October of 1943 by the definitive B-17 model, the G model. And you can always tell the G model by the chin turret underneath the nose of the plane. Then every plane had identifying tail markings, again, to see the triangle H of the 306 bomb group. That also had an identification number that was assigned by the manufacturer. The Boeing company designed and produced 60% of the B-17s, but Lockheed, Vega, and Douglas Aircraft each produced 20% as well. Here you see the crew positions on the plane. Again, this is a G model with the chin turret. You had the bombardier and navigator in the nose, and above them, the two pilots, and then behind them, the flight engineer, and then the bomb bay, a radio operator, then below, you have the belly gunner, and two waist gunners and a tail gunner. Yeah, the bombs hung up in racks in the bomb bay, and it was really tight in there. This boy is only 8 years old, and that catwalk that you see is only 8 inches wide. So it was pretty cramped in there. It was more crowded and cramped in a B-17 than it was in a submarine. And occasionally these bombs, which were hung up on clips, racks in the plane, would get stuck. And that would require one of the crewmen either kick it loose with his foot or take a wrench and lock it loose. And when those bomb bay doors are open, you're looking 5 miles straight down to the earth with the wind howling around you. So that took some courage to do that. Here you see the crew positions a little more clearly. Again, this is the F model with no chin turret. In the front, you have the bombardier, whose main job is to drop the bombs accurately. But in the G model, he manned the chin turret when they were under attack by enemy fighters. Then you have the navigator behind him. He needed to know where they were and where they were going. And when under attack, he manned cheek guns that were on each side of the nose of the plane. Then you have the two pilots, the first pilot in the left seat, the co-pilot in the right seat. And you needed two pilots to fly these planes, and not just because if one was injured or killed, you had another guy that could do the job. But it was very strenuous flying these planes, both physically and mentally. These missions lasted 6 to 12 hours, so it was very tiring. And they flew in tight formations, and they had to stay alert at all times. They could clip a wing on the plane next to them or run in the plane in front of them and go down. And they continuously had to fight the turbulence. Many of you experience, you know, the natural turbulence of weather when you get bumped around. But also they had the turbulence from all those bombers being in such close proximity to one another. So the wake turbulence and the prop wash would just churn the air up like a washing machine. And then behind the two pilots, you have the flight engineer. He manned the top turret when they were under attack. He was also called the crew chief. He was kind of like the onboard mechanic and knew how everything operated. And he helped monitor all the instruments around the cockpit. There are over 150 different gauges, dials, switches, and toggles. And he would peer over the pilot's shoulders to help monitor engine performance and fuel consumption. Then behind the bomb bay, you had the radio operator. He had the most comfortable position on the plane. He had a relatively roomy compartment and a chair to sit at. And then the most cramped position on the plane, the ball turret gunner. Again, these missions lasted, you know, 6 to 12 hours, and he was in this fetal position for hours on end, so that was pretty uncomfortable. Then above the ball, he had the two waist gunners, which were the most exposed positions on the plane, and then another cramped position, the tail gunner. My dad and his crew flew their first mission on November 3rd of 1943 to Wilhelmshaven. And flying combat missions was extremely dangerous and absolutely brutal. At the peak, there were 40 bomb groups in the 8th Air Force stationed in East Anglia, which was about the size of Vermont. And these bomber bases were only about 5 to 10 miles apart. So on the day of a mission, you could have hundreds of bombers all taken off at the same time. And back then, there was no air traffic control, there was no radar, and usually the weather in England was pretty crummy and overcast, and you couldn't see anything until you got above the cloud layer. So mid-air collisions were not uncommon. Then they had to form up. Individual planes formed up into three-plane elements. Elements formed up into bomb squadrons. Bomb squadrons formed up into bomb groups. Bomb groups formed up into combat wings. Combat wings formed up into air divisions. And that took an hour to 2 hours before they could even begin their mission across the English Channel. And then they had to deal with the elements. These planes weren't pressurized, so above 10,000 feet, they had to go on oxygen, or else in a couple minutes they'd pass out and could die. And also it was extremely cold at the altitude that they were flying. It was minus 40 to 60 degrees below zero. So frostbite was a huge problem. One of my dad's waist gunners was in the hospital for 2.5 months because of the seriousness of his frostbite injuries. Here you see the combat uniform that they wear. This is a waist gunner. He has a steel helmet on, his tinted goggles, his oxygen mask. And he's wearing a flak jacket that was an apron with metal plates in front and back to try to protect him. And his fleece-lined jacket and pants, thermal gloves and boots. And then you see the white strap around his waist that was a parachute harness. It was so cramped in the plane that most crewmen didn't wear their parachutes. If they had to bail out, they'd have to find their parachute to begin with and then hook it on clips to the back of the harness and then bail out of the plane. This isn't a B-17, this is a B-24 Liberator, but again, you'll see the creative nose art on the plane there. The next thing they had to deal with was enemy aircraft. Germany had radar stations set up along the continental coast of Europe, so they knew when these bomber formations were coming, and they'd send up their air force, the Luftwaffe, to intercept them. Here you see a waist gunner again firing his 50 caliber machine gun with his flak jacket on, and you see all those spent cartridges on the floor of the plane. That was like stepping on ball bearings or, you know, marbles. And the ammunition for the 50 caliber guns came in belts of 27 feet long. So if they fired the whole belt, he said, he fired the whole 9 yards. And many people believe that's where that expression came from. At the beginning of the war, it was 8th Bomber Command's belief that these heavily armed bombers flying in tight formations of hundreds of bombers at a time could defend themselves from the Luftwaffe. And they flew in what was called a combat box formation. And here you see the box of a combat wing, and then within the box of the wing, you have 3 boxes representing bomb groups. And then with each bomb group, you have 3 boxes representing bomb squadrons. So the theory was that all this interlacing firepower could defend themselves from the Luftwaffe. But unfortunately, at the beginning of the war, that was not the case. These bombers could not defend themselves from the Luftwaffe. And even when they gave them some fighter support at the time, the fighters didn't have the fuel capacity to escort the bombers all the way into Germany. They could get across the channel, but then they'd be running out of fuel. They'd have to turn around and go back to their bases. And the losses were particularly devastating in 1943. Even though they implemented that mission of 25 in April of 43, it was statistically impossible to complete 25 missions. In 1943, the average number of missions flown before being shot down was 6. And the losses culminated in October of that year in what was referred to as Black Week, when over 4 missions, the 8th Air Force lost 114 planes. The worst day was October 14th, Black Thursday, when they sent 291 bombers to hit the ball bearing factories at Schweinfurt, Germany, and they lost 60 bombers on one mission. That's 600 men. The 306 lost 10 of the 15 B-17s that they sent on that mission. Well, the 8th Air Force was in shock. There was just no way they could sustain those losses, and they discontinued flying into Germany for the rest of the year. It wasn't until right at the end of 43 and the beginning of 1944 where they finally got adequate fighter support. They could escort them all the way deep into Germany and then back again. And that was when the P-47 Thunderbolts got external fuel tanks added to them and the introduction of the P-51 Mustang. The Mustangs were, this was another picture of the bomber formation, again from the back, from the top, and from the side. It was a 3-dimensional formation with a high group, low group, and then a lead group. Here, see the P-51 Mustang. This is actually Tom Cruise's P-51 Mustang, which was in the movie Top Gun Maverick that he flew. It's stationed at the Planes of Fame Air Museum in Chino. But the P-51 Mustangs were particularly effective. By the time D-Day rolled around on June 6th of 1944, they had pretty much decimated the Luftwaffe, and it was just a shell of itself. And the U.S. and the Allies had achieved air supremacy. The next thing they had to deal with on these missions was anti-aircraft fire. This is a flak gun. Flak was the abbreviation for the German word for aircraft defense cannon. And these were deadly weapons. They fired 20 shells a minute, and the shells were calibrated to explode at the altitude that these bombers were flying. And these shells were filled with all different shapes and sizes of razor-sharp metal called shrapnel. And when the shell exploded, it was burst out hundreds of feet and easily penetrate the thin aluminum skin of these bombers. The skin on these bombers was so thin you could just take a screwdriver and poke it right through it. From a distance, it looked like innocent black puffs, but when these bomber formations got into that killing field, those puffs got bigger, the explosions got deafening, and if a shell exploded near the ship, it would just violently rock the bomber. If a bomber was hit directly, it would basically disintegrate and disappear, or if it hit a wing, that bomber would just plummet to the earth like a stone. My dad said even though it was so cold at the altitude they were flying, he would be sweating profusely and his clothes would be dripping with sweat with the adrenaline running through his body. When they reached pre-designated points on the bomb run, they reached a point what's called the IP, or initial point where they started the bomb run. And at that time, the first pilot would give control over the plane to the bombardier who would fly the plane through the Norden bomb site, which was tied into the automatic pilot of the bomber. This was a revolutionary device at the time. It was an analog computer that could calculate the altitude the plane was flying, the speed the plane was flying, the wind speed, wind direction, so they could accurately drop the bombs. It was also highly secretive as well. Bombardiers had to take an oath that they would defend this with their life. But little did the U.S. know at the time that the Germans knew everything about the Norden bomb site because they had a spy, Hermann Lange, in the Norden bomb site factory. Here you see the bombardier looking through the crosshairs of the Norden bomb site. And once he released the bombs, he would say, "Bombs away." And that would signal the first pilot to take control of the plane back and just make a big turn and go to another designated point called the rally point, where the bombers that made it through the formation would try to form up again and then head back to their bases in England, where once again they would face enemy fighters. And even when they did reach England, they faced many dangers. The weather could be bad, they could be socked in with clouds and they couldn't even find their bases. They could be running out of fuel, could be injured or dead pilots on the plane. It could be have suffered a lot of battle damage, engine shot out, flight control shot out. So many crash landings took place where more airmen lost their lives. It was on a bombing mission to Frankfurt, Germany on February 8th of 1944 that my dad's plane dropped its bombs successfully. But the bomb bay doors got hit by flak and they couldn't get them back up. And a result that caused a drag in the plane, they lost airspeed and they fell behind the bomber formation going back to England. And they were singled out by two German Focke-Wulf 190 fighters. And like wolves or lions on prey, they came in for the kill and the ensuing air battle, the Susan Ruth was shot down. But both those German fighters were shot down as well. One was piloted by Siegfried Merrick. His plane crashed and he died in the plane. And the other was piloted by Hans Berger, who was able to bail out and made it through the war. During my research, one day my wife Glenda said, "Well, why don't you try to find the German pilot that shot down your dad's plane?" And I'm thinking, "Oh, gosh, she's so naive. She has no idea what she's talking about. It'd be impossible to find him." But like a good husband, I did what she told me to do, and I found Hans Berger. And fortunately for me, he became a translator after the war, so he speaks perfect English. And he gave me wonderful insight about what it was like to go up against the 8th Air Force that is in the book. I mentioned that the book goes into detail about what happened to each member of the crew. I don't have time to do that today. To find that out, you'll have to buy a copy of my book. But after my dad bailed out, he came down in some trees right at the French-Belgian border, and his parachute got hung up on the branches of the tree, and he was dangling 20 feet off the ground and couldn't get down. But fortunately for him, a couple young Belgian men, Henri Franken and Raymond Durvan, came to his rescue before the Germans got there. They got a ladder from the farmhouse and a rope, and they helped him down this tree. That's Henri Franken, one of the men that helped my dad down from the tree. These pictures were taken or sent to my dad after the war. And there's over 200 time period photographs in the book, so you can visualize everything you're reading about. This occurred in early afternoon. They told my dad to stay hidden and stay put because they thought it was too dangerous to try to move him in daylight with German patrols combing the area. But that night they came back and got him, and they took him to the Durvan farmhouse, that farmhouse is in Belgium and those trees are in France. So it's right at the border. Well, that house is still there today. He stayed there one night, again, because they thought it was too dangerous for him to stay there any longer than that with those German patrols still around. So the next night, a Belgian customs officer, Paul Tilcan, came on a tandem bicycle to take him to a safer location. And so they headed out. My dad said it was the middle of the night, pitch black, you know, rainy. And my dad had some shrapnel wounds in one leg, so he could only pedal with his good leg. When they came to a hill, they couldn't pedal up the hill, so they got off the bike and started walking up the hill. And they came to this building, which a picture of it in 1994, which at the time was a little cafe, a cabaret, and the lights were on, music was playing, people were laughing and talking loudly. And all of a sudden, two German officers come walking out with these two young French girls. One of them comes up to my dad, puts his arm around him, and asks him for a light for his cigarette. Well, my dad is petrified. He can't speak German. He couldn't speak French at that time, but Paul, you know, knew what they wanted and lit the guy's cigarette. And they let my dad and Paul go on their way. My dad said they were too drunk, or as he would put it, schnockered, and too interested in these young French girls to pay much attention to a couple of guys pushing a bicycle, you know, in the middle of the night. And after that, my dad was moved from place to place to place. How long he stayed in any given location depended on how brave the people were who lived there and how dangerous the Belgium underground thought it was for him to stay there. He might spend one night, he might spend 6 weeks. Here you see some of the people that helped my dad. He had many more Belgian helpers than this, but this gives you an idea of them. My dad is on the left there. They put a beret on him to help him try to blend in with the locals. But being 6'3", he was pretty, you know, quite a bit taller than the locals. And the people who hid my dad, or any downed airman for that matter, were unbelievably brave people. They risked not only their lives, but the lives of family and friends. Because the German secret police, the Gestapo, found out about it, they'd be arrested, sent to prison, tortured, and sometimes executed or sent to a concentration camp. And some of the people who helped my dad and other members of his crew did meet that fate. Here you see a couple women that my dad stayed with for lengthy periods of time. On the left is Ghislaine Bayou. It was with her and her husband, Maurice, that my dad wrote his diary. And on the right is Jeanette Gadin. Her husband was actually a captain in the French army and was captured when Germany first invaded the lowlands in 1940, and he spent the remainder of the year, or the remainder of the war, as a POW. Normally, when the underground came across downed airmen, they tried to get them back to England through various escape routes, down through France, over the Pyrenees, into Spain, and then out through British-controlled Gibraltar. But something always went wrong trying to get my dad out. You know, these networks got compromised or different things happened. And he became very frustrated with that. And also he had several close calls of almost being discovered by the Germans. On one occasion, he was staying at the Bayou house, Maria and Ghislaine. And there was a loud pounding on the door at middle of the night. And Maurice told my dad to go up and get up on the roof. And then he'd come back and get him when the Germans left the area. But they never did leave the area for the entire night. My dad spent the entire night on the roof. And I've been in this house, and then you can't see it from this angle, but there's a little attic in the roof that it's only about that wide. You know, you can barely squeeze through it. And the roof is very slanted with a tile roof. I mean, it would be scary just climbing up there. That's another thing that's been very amazing. So many of these places, they're still there today that you can visit where history took place. So it's pretty emotional going to these places where my dad was hidden. Finally, my dad got tired of hiding. Word came that the Allies had landed at Normandy on June 6th, and he decided to get back in the fight. Unlike most airmen, he had that year's experience of infantry training in the army, so he knew how to fight on the ground. So he decided to join the French resistance. His helpers tried to talk him out of it because it was way too dangerous. He could be killed fighting against the Germans, or if the Germans captured him, he'd be shot on the spot as a terrorist. But he thought it was his duty to get back into the war. There were other Americans fighting and dying for his country, and he thought it was his duty to do that as well. How many people would have made that decision? I don't know, but very few. The smartest or safest thing would have been for him to stay hunkered down in hiding and wait for U.S. armies to come up through France to liberate the area. But he convinced one of his helpers, Amy Cools, to accompany him on bicycles down to the border, and he joined a unit of the French resistance called the Mackie. This is not the group that my dad joined, but it would gives you a picture of what they look like. The Mackie was small, independent, ragtag guerrilla groups located all across France, and they were supplied by the British through drops, and they were also given their information by the British through coded messages over the BBC. And their job was to harass the Germans. They would assassinate German officers. They would sabotage railroad lines. They would disrupt communications, attacked convoys. And my dad said the information the British gave him was unbelievably accurate. If they said a German convoy was coming down this road on this day at this time, sure enough, they would be there. And that was a result of the British cracking the German Enigma code and knowing everything that they were up to. This is the farmhouse that the Mackie group stayed in. Here's a picture of my dad in front of it in 1994. And he stayed in that tower where you see those two windows. And on one occasion, it was early morning, he just had his skivvies on, his shaving cream on his face, and he looked out the window and saw German patrol coming up the road. So he had to jump out of those grain windows on the second floor and hightail it into the woods to avoid being captured. There are several encounters that the Mackie group had with Germans that are in the book, which are pretty thrilling. Who took this picture and how it ever got back to my dad, I'll never know, but this is him fighting with the French resistance in 1944, jumping out of that Jeep. Finally, 7 months after bailing out, word came that there were U.S. troops in the nearby village of Trelon, France. So my dad walked into the village, into the town square, and went up to an army major. Actually, it was an element of Patton's Third Army, which would come up through France after D-Day. He identified himself, and then he caught a ride on a convoy taking German prisoners to Paris, and then hopped on a transport and got back to his base in England, where he sent a Western Union telegram to my mother saying, back at base, fit as a fiddle. Bank the money, honey, because he had all that back pay coming from those 7 months missing in action. Belgium is a wonderful little country. It's very unique. A lot of people don't realize it's really divided in two. The upper half of Belgium is called Flanders, which is rather industrial, and they speak a dialect of Dutch, Flemish. And then the lower half of Belgium is called Wallonia, where they speak French, and it's all rural countryside. Can't really see it here, but on the bottom there, the lowest part, below Charleroi, that my dad was hidden in Charleroi for a while, but if go down there right at the French-Belgian border, that's where the plane and the guys who were able to bail out came down. My dad and the plane actually came down in Belgium, and the other guys that were able to bail out came down in France and then were brought across the border into Belgium, either by Germans who captured him or by the French resistance. And to this day, the Belgian people are still so grateful and so thankful for the Americans and allies coming to their rescue and liberating them from 4 years of Nazi occupation and Nazi oppression. And they do a great job of educating the younger generations as well. In 1984, Dr. Paul Delahaye, that I showed you in that picture earlier, formed the Belgium American Foundation to remember and honor Americans who came and liberated their country. And over the years, they erected a number of memorials in the area to remember events that took place on the anniversary dates of those events. They have ceremonies. But the big ceremonies are all around September 2nd, the date that that area was liberated by the U.S. Army. And there are wonderful events. Again, I just attended the 80th anniversary earlier this month. They last several days. This is a poster from the 70th anniversary. They erect these big tents that seat hundreds of people. This is just a portion of one. And they have band concerts and dances and lunches and dinners, and there's so much fun. The local people, you know, dress in period uniforms. The local beer, Chimay, just flows, and everyone has a swell time. There's a lot of reenactors that set up a U.S. Army camp, and they have a reenactment of all the military vehicles crossing over into Belgium to liberate the country. But they have many ceremonies and memorials that were more serious and very moving events. This is at the memorial at Cendron, which is right at the French-Belgian border, where the 9th U.S. Infantry first crossed from over the Wartroz River from France into Belgium to liberate the country. And all the local villagers come out, all the dignitaries, local dignitaries make speeches. The U.S. military is there, the Belgian military, French military, the U.S. ambassador to Belgium comes down with an entourage. And they're wonderful events. Again, you can see in the first row all those young people sitting there, again, to emphasize to them the importance of remembering. This is the memorial to my dad and his crew, which was erected in the little hamlet of Mackenwas, Belgium. It was right near where the plane came down in 1989. And at the dedication of this event, my dad and the three other members that were still living at the time of his crew went over for the dedication. And there my dad was reunited with all these people that had hidden him and revisited these places where he was hidden, and that brought it all back. Because like most World War II veterans, my dad didn't talk about the war much until he went over for this dedication. Here you see my dad in the tie, that's Dr. Delahaye with the beard to the left. And then the woman in the trench coat is Jeanette Gadin, who I showed you in that earlier picture. The older woman is Nellie Tilcan, who's the wife of the Belgian customs officer, Paul Tilcan. A couple months after Paul helped my dad, he was arrested by the Germans, sent to prison, tortured, and narrowly escaped being executed. But from the beatings he took, he developed a brain tumor, and he died 10 years later. And then the other man in the trench coat there is Raymond Durvan. He was the other man that helped my dad down from the trees. My first visit to Belgium was 1994 with my parents, and that's when it became personal for me because I went around all these places to see where the events took place, met Nellie Tilcan. That's me on the left, my dad, my mother, and then that's my other sister, Nancy. Nancy was actually born while my dad was missing in action, so that was really tough on my mom at the time. She had a one-year-old, you know, Susan, and an infant, Nancy, and never knowing if she would ever see her husband again. This year was my 7th trip to Belgium, but on 2 of the trips to Belgium, I continued over to Germany to visit that Luftwaffe pilot that shot down my dad's plane, Hans Berger. And we became friends. Here he is in his apartment. You can't really, that's his fighter jacket, and he has his Iron Cross on. You really can't see that too well. He shot down 7 B-17s and 1 Spitfire. And most all of his friends were killed during the war. The only reason I think that he made it through World War II is that right at the beginning of 1945, he was pulled out of combat to become a test pilot for the Henkel HE-162 single-engine jet fighter that the Nazis were trying to perfect, which they never did. But that probably saved his life. And like I said, we became friends. You know, he was, after all, pretty much just like the American pilots, not, you know, 20 years old, you know, fighting for his country, you know, doing a duty for his country, fighting for his country, and trying to stay alive. I had hoped to go visit Hans one last time, you know, this month, but unfortunately, he died this past January at the age of 100 years old. He was the last living person that, of all the people involved in the shot down story, he was the last living person. And then here you see Hans and me at the Hofbrau House having a cold one. This is me and my dad at the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. This picture was taken in 2004. He wanted to go see that before he died, and I accompanied him to a reunion of the Air Force's Escape and Evasion Society, and it was right before its official dedication. And that was the last trip he ever took. He died 3 years later in 2007 at the age of 91. He wasn't the last crew member to die, but he was the oldest. And all the World War II veterans today are either in their late 90s or early hundreds. There were 16 million World War II veterans. And today, as from this chart, you can see have been, you know, dwindling, and now there's less than 100,000 of those men still with us. I mentioned I'm attending the 8th Air Force Historical Society reunion next week, and we only have four veterans able to make the reunion. There was no other event in history that affected more people than World War II. 60 million people died, millions more were wounded, millions more were left homeless and displaced. It changed the course of America and the world forever. And the brave young men who fought and died for freedom are, to me, without a doubt, the greatest generation. We can never forget the sacrifice of these young men. It is our duty to remember. Thank you. If anyone has any questions, I'll field some. Yes, sir. The question was, did my dad and I ever go up in a B-17 together? I've been up twice. My dad went up, but we never went up together. I did go up before he died in 2004 and then again in 2010, but it's a wonderful experience. If you've never been inside a B-17, you have no idea really or comprehension how cramped it is in there because they look big from a distance. And going up, it gives you chills. Being in one of those, when they start the engines and it starts vibrating and then they start moving, it gives you just a little taste of what it must have been like. Yes, sir. The question is, did my mother ever get any notification my dad was missing, that he was alive? No, none whatsoever. On February 23rd, she got a telegram from the War Department saying that he was missing in action. And then a couple of months later, another telegram saying he was still missing in action. You know, and the telegram says, you know, a lot of times they're not dead, you know, but they were captured and they're POWs. But the POWs of the men that were captured by the Germans, they were able to write home. So eventually you knew when, you know, if a guy was a POW or not. And my dad didn't know what happened to any of his members of the crew until he got back to his base in England. Yeah, the question is, the gentleman heard that there were a bunch of paratroopers coming down in Europe. And yes, that is true. It was to celebrate Operation Market Garden, which was, I think, the 17th of September of 1944. And they did the same on D-Day. They always do that on June 6th. There's all these C-47 transports that fly over to Europe. And a lot of reenactors who parachute out of the plane to signify D-Day and also Operation Market Garden. D-Day was a big success, but Market Garden was a huge failure. But that actually took place in the Netherlands, not Belgium. Yes, sir. Question was, how many missions did my dad fly? He was shot down on his 8th mission. Other question, did he ever run across the Tuskegee Airmen? My dad was in the 8th Air Force. The Tuskegee Airmen were actually in the 15th Air Force out of Italy. So no, he did not. Some of the other members of my dad's crew had twice as many missions as him. Some had fewer missions. They only flew together on the last two missions. There was always guys getting hurt, and because of the cold, you know, wet weather in England, guys were getting sick, getting the flu, pneumonia all the time. So you rarely flew with your full crew. There were always guys, for one reason or another, that were missing. And so just the last two missions is the only time my dad's full crew flew together. My dad, being 6'3", he was on the basketball team. And actually played center, you know, back then at 6'3". But he tore the ligaments in his ankles, and so he couldn't fly for 2 months, and that's why some of the other guys had many more missions than him. Yes, sir.
Did your dad continue flying after he
got
back to
England? The question was, my dad, did he continue flying after he got back to England? I'll answer that in two parts. One, the Air Force had a rule, if you were shot down and aided by the underground, that you couldn't go back into combat. Because they thought if you were shot down a second time, captured by the Germans and tortured, that you'd give up the identity of the people that helped you the first time. So he was sent back to the States and he became a B-17 flight instructor for the remainder of the war. But after the war, no, he never flew again at all after the war. He just wanted, like a lot of guys, just to get on with his wife. After all, you know, he was married. He was one of three of the crew members that were married, the only one that had a child. But now he came home to two little baby girls. So he didn't fly anymore after that. I was never exposed to aviation, and now I'm around planes all the time because I go to air shows all around the country signing copies of my book. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
How long did it take
me to write the book? From the time I started my research to the time the book was published was 4.5 years, and it took me 12 months to actually write the manuscript. Question is, do I still have the telegrams that my mom got? Yeah, I have all those telegrams. I have all the letters my dad wrote to my mother. I have letters from some of the crew's relatives. After the plane was shot down, there were a lot of letters written between the wives, the mothers, the sweethearts, who, an unbelievable state, you know, not knowing if their loved one would be shot down. There's excerpts from those letters are in the book, which are very moving, you know, trying to console each other, you know, expressing their belief in God that things would work out okay. And I have letters from some of my dad's helpers that were written to him after the war. So I really have a lot of information, and then all those pictures that were taken in 1944 as well. Question was, what did my dad do after the war? He owned a restaurant in Pasadena for 10 years, Snyder's on Colorado Boulevard. And then he became so disgusted with the cooks because they would never show up. He decided to learn how to cook, and he became the chef. My dad was a really good cook. He loved to cook. He cooked as much as my mom did. Then he sold the restaurant after 10 years, and he did a bunch of different things, selling various products, you know, encyclopedias, these air mattresses to the VA hospitals, tie cleaners, and but none of them really did anywhere, went anywhere. But then finally he went to work as the exclusive sales manufacturer's rep for Acura Stamp Machine Company. And they made these machines that dialed like a telephone, you know, back in the days when you had redemption stamps, the blue chip and S&H stamps. Well, he would sell these machines to all the grocery chains around the country and gas stations. And then he eventually actually purchased the company and ran it for a couple of years and then sold it. Fortunately, like the year before redemption stamps went out of favor. And then he retired on that. Yeah. The question was, how long did it take my dad to start talking about his experience of the war? Like I said, you know, I knew the basics, and he would talk, you know, say little things, you know, now and then, and actually the crew members that survived, they would get together now and then. But, you know, when you're a kid, you know, you just don't realize the importance of these things. And then even when you get older, you know, you go into school or you get a job or you have a family. And, you know, I hear all the time from people that, you know, they hardly know anything about what their veteran did during the war because they didn't talk about it. And then whether it's a nephew or a daughter or a son, they didn't ask him about it. But my dad was proud of his service. And so he did talk about it some, and I knew the general story. And like I said, he really started talking about it after that trip to Belgium for the dedication of the memorial. But I got a whole new appreciation when I started doing my research and about the courage that he had and the bravery that he had, especially by joining the French Resistance. But also, you know, the book's just not a tribute to my dad, but it's a tribute to his crew, every guy that was in the 8th Air Force. I mean, there was being a combat crewman in the 8th Air Force during World War II was the most dangerous duty assignment in the United States military. But also a tribute to all the World War II veterans. You know, like I said, they are the greatest generation. You know, they were citizen soldiers, you know, that they just answered the call of their country and risked their lives trying to preserve freedom. Well, thank you very much for coming out. I really appreciate it.